It's important to realize that the path of self-realization is not a promise that you'll find the truth of it after you die. It's a daily experience of ever-increasing happiness, greater strength, a deeper ability to love, an expansion of sympathy. One of the fundamental differences in a very real sense between the scientific practice of yoga as a spiritual path and so many religions is simply that. Swamiji describes it in another place. He talks about people tend to think of the spiritual path a little bit like climbing Mount Everest, that you just struggle and struggle, and the higher you get, the thinner the air gets, the more difficult the struggle, the greater the danger that you'll just make some final catastrophic error and that you'll die, and that even if you reach the summit, you'll become so disoriented you won't know what to do. And it really is. There's this lingering thought of difficulty. And especially when we see the lives of the masters and we see the magnitude of the self-offering that they're asked to make, and sometimes the hand-to-hand combat that they have to engage in with conceivably their own nature or with the force of Maya or the force of Satan trying to stop them from expanding. Recently, we've been looking at a film about Padre Pio. Padre Pio was a priest who lived from before the First World War until about the end of the 1960s in Italy, and he bore the marks of Christ on his body for 50 years. He was a great saint. And Padre Pio, partly because of the context in which he lived, but he was constantly being assaulted by astral demons and wild dogs and terrible dark voices. I mean, it's very medieval when you see it. But all the great masters, in one way or another, speak of this fact that you have this point where you simply have to confront that force which is trying to hold us to a limited view of reality, and we have to have the courage to go beyond it. Now, at the same time, because Jesus did die on the cross, there's been this legacy that's come down, especially through Christianity, that the spiritual path is suffering. And the more advanced you get, the more really god-awful it becomes. And we have this picture of Christ, you know, just celebrated over and over again, because the crucifixion became the definition of Christianity, whereas in fact the resurrection is the definition, not the crucifixion. But we somehow stopped sort of halfway there. And the ego also has a strong tendency to glom on to that image, because it wants to be frightened of the spiritual path. It wants to justify all efforts not to follow it. I mean, it's only common sense. Self-protection is one of the fundamental aspects of life, and the ego and its bundle of self-definitions wants to hold on to itself. We're comfortable where we are, even though we're miserable. That's one of the strangest paradoxes of the whole thing, is that which we call happiness is really just a shadow of true bliss, and a good solid part of us knows this, and yet at the same time we're so eager not to risk even this tiny little morsel that we have with the more or less vague promise of something more. Now, in truth, none of this is really the way the spiritual path is, because what we're working with on the spiritual path is a very simple concept, and that concept is self-mastery. We call it self-realization. Sometimes we speak of it as self-forgetfulness, but a very good way to look at it is simply self-mastery. You see, that's what it is that the masters project. What they project is this transcendent, completely transcendent understanding of the nature of life. Yesterday, in the course of our all-day meditation, we listened to Rajasi Janakananda, who was Master's most advanced disciple, who was himself, Master said, a fully realized being. And Rajasi almost never spoke. He was an extremely accomplished businessman, I mean, literally a millionaire, a self-made millionaire. before he met Yet Master and became a disciple, he was already well established in the business world. And even in that world, he was known as a very silent man. He only spoke when he had something to say. And in the spiritual world, Swami Kriyananda said, Rajasi almost never spoke. And when you would ask him anything, he would often just say, Om Guru, Om Guru, Om Guru. It just wasn't his nature. He saw no reason to comment on whatever was going on inside or outside. But he'd been asked to introduce Master. So he stood up and spoke just a little bit. Afterwards, Master said it was the most words he'd ever heard Rajasi speak at one time. And Rajasi said a few very simple things. He said, let's be realistic. What is the nature of life? Why were we born? What does it mean to be alive? What is life? And how do we fulfill whatever destiny it is we've come to experience? And then he just speaks very simply, how fortunate we are that the masters have come to show us the true way. And none of us want to think, and no one would follow a path that says, oh, the true way is agony. Oh, you think you were having a good time, comfortable in your house with your little family? Let me tell you, now we get to walk on thorns and be beaten and hammered by life and in the end die an ignoble death and, you know, follow me. Who would? You know, it's just crazy. And yet we have these marvelous stories in the life of Jesus, especially since it's Christmas time. Jesus walks by the seashore and his chosen disciples see him and feel in him something that they've never even imagined before. Jesus turns to them and says, follow me. And they drop everything and do that. Now, we have to appreciate that even though those disciples were highly advanced souls, their consciousness was merely an extension of who we ourselves are, even at this time. And it's very important when we look at the lives of the masters that we project ourselves into that life and have the self-confidence to realize that the way those who met Jesus behaved is exactly the way we could behave. Whether we would have or not, we don't know, but we could have. And so it had to have been that when those disciples saw Jesus, they felt in him something that they deeply and profoundly were attracted to. And what are we attracted to? We're attracted to a few fundamental things. Human nature's the same. We want love. We want to be accepted and understood for who we really are. We want a sense of deep security. We want to overcome fear. And above all, we want to be happy. When it all comes down to it, everything else that we describe is just that simple feeling of being happy inside ourselves. We elevate that word to the concept of bliss, to describe it as something that can't be touched. But nonetheless, joy is what every man and every woman, every being is seeking. That's the cry that goes up. When I was on the spiritual path, I got onto the spiritual path when I was 19 years old. And I studied teachings that are very closely related to this one, the path of self-realization in a very pure form. But I had this terrible dilemma in my life, which is I understood that what I was reading was true. I understood the theory that self-mastery was possible and that bliss was the goal of life and it could be mine. But I couldn't understand how to extricate myself from the ordinary process of life. Later I thought of it like a cork in a wine bottle. You know, it's really stuck in there and you can't just sort of pull it a little bit and have it come out. You have to dig into it and then pull it out with a certain amount of force. And life holds us like that, isn't that so? We get our jobs, we get our friends, we get our families, we get our place to live, we get our little systems in place. I have my breakfast here and then I read the newspaper and on Sundays I do this and I always buy a mocha, you know, at that particular place, and he knows my order when I just walk in. You know, all these different little pieces that sort of make up the little process of our lives. When David and I had to move from the apartment in our community where we'd lived for like 18 years into what is really a nicer home, Chela Bhavan, at the community, which many of you have visited, nonetheless, I was deeply impressed by how much I didn't want to leave that apartment. No objective analysis would say, why would you stay there when you could move into this one? But the one I had lived in was mine. The one I had lived in had all my little patterns in it. This is where I had my breakfast. This is where I would sit to meditate. This is where I would stand and look at the maple tree. This is the chair where Swami would sit. You know, all those little things. I was appalled, is the only word I can use. I was both stunned and appalled to see the extent to which my little ego had just sunk its roots into something so unimportant in the greater scheme of things is all my own little patterns. But it gives me great respect for the power of Maya to persuade us that whatever we have, if it's ours, we should keep it, because after all, it's mine. What Swamiji calls the bundle of self-definitions of the ego. Well, anyway, I was back then when I was 20 years old, and I had this thought in my mind that spiritual truth was possible, but I just didn't know how to make that shift. And Swami Kriyananda came into my world. He came into my world in November of 1969, and I was in a public gathering, and he walked into the room. And I understand what happened to the disciples of Christ, because in my own tiny way, that's exactly what happened when Swami walked into the room. There was an aura about him of, I know who I am, I know where I am going, I know what the path is, and I can take you there. And he communicated all that to me, at least, in a matter of 10 seconds. And I'm not exaggerating, because it was the practical expression of, okay, let's turn this whole reality around. Let's turn it around from looking at the material world as the real world and the spiritual world is so distant and how are we ever going to get to it, to making the spiritual world as real and everything else is really just a shadow. And above all, more than anything else, what these masters really communicate to us, if we'll open our hearts to really experience it, is what they communicate is exactly what it is that we are seeking. Freedom, joy, security, a sense of being personally loved and understood in a way that no one else in this earth can give it to us. And then we hold that up, you know, this little bit of the ephemeral world versus that eternity of bliss. And so there's a little bit of a struggle in the middle. What we really find on the spiritual path above all is that every step we take closer to that divine light, to that extent that divine light floods us. And yes, there may be a contrary weight, you know, that we have to drag a little bit. We may have to do a little battle with our own nature, but we're doing battle for reasons that we know. And the struggle of the soul is just the contrast between that touch of the infinite that's come to us and this little tiny bit that we just can't let go. In the story of the life of Christ, everything about Scripture is designed to give us a touch of that understanding. And one of the most beautiful stories in the life of Christ is this story of the Star of Bethlehem. You know, in the time that Jesus lived, these things could not be talked about explicitly. Most of mankind simply couldn't understand it. So the images were buried deep. And Christianity has become very sectarian in its teaching in the centuries since Jesus died. But even this first story of Jesus' birth was meant to show us that this isn't a universal teaching that applies to everyone. Because the image that they're working with, the Star of Bethlehem, is really the image that every conscious being, human being, can perceive interior to our own selves when we do the practices in the right way and just shut our eyes and look at that light. In Assisi, Italy, they were wanting to make out of blown glass an image of the spiritual eye. The one we have above our altar here is of painted glass. They wanted to do it out of blown glass, and they wanted the cobalt blue. And they were looking all over Italy, literally, and Germany, for someone who could do the work that they needed. And finally, by sheer intuition, Arjuna, who was in charge of the project, came to this glass blower in a certain place, and they showed him the image that they wanted to make. I mean, this is, and I can't remember the details of the story, but it was almost literally that Arjuna was wandering around in a city in Italy. I think there was a street name that had some spiritual significance, and he went down that street and he saw the shop and he went in. And he describes to this man the work that they wanted to have done for this glass piece. And the man's eyes began to just open extremely wide, and he could hardly believe what was being told. And he said to Arjuna, he said, "My whole life," he said, "whenever I'm very still in prayer," he said, "I've always seen that exact image. The circle of gold, the dark blue field, and the star in the center." He said, "No one could ever tell me what it meant. You're the first person who's ever explained it to me." And Arjuna was explaining to him that these are the images of the world beyond the material. The golden circle represents the astral world. The dark blue ring is the causal world. The astral world is the world of energy from which the material world emanates. The causal world is the world of ideas, where the thought of creation begins in the mind of God and then expands out into energy and then comes down as matter. And the white star is the Christ consciousness itself, the power of God beyond all creation. This is what the yogis teach. This is why we have this image above us. When we were making this image for our altar at first, we had this idea to make it very large as you see it. And many people thought this could never work. So we decided we just had to experiment with it. So one year, a number of years ago, I got down on my living room floor and I made a great big circle. That piece was, I think this is 4 feet in diameter. That was 5 foot square of circle of cardboard, which we then covered with Christmas wrap, blue, and then pasted the star in the middle and stuck it up on the wall here. We had it on the wall here for several years before we were able to translate it in the form that we had. With quote, temporary, but it just stood up there. Then we asked Swamiji, because no one had ever made the star this big, the spiritual eye this big, we said, "Sure, should we make it this large in relation to the pictures of the masters?" The idea was, you see, that the masters themselves emanate from the spiritual eye. That was the symbology we wanted to create, that the masters come after the spiritual eye. First, you have the Christ consciousness represented by the star, then the masters emanate, and then all of us. And Swamiji said, "Oh yes, by all means make it large." In fact, he said, "It should look big enough that we can walk into it." That's how he said it. The size here is limited only by the architectural dimensions, otherwise we might have made it even bigger. But that's what we're really talking about. We're talking about a world that makes this one look like nothing. Not that this world is nothing, you see, but this is the last effect. Jyotish put it once, which I loved. He said, "We are, right at this moment, the most compressed, least expansive expression of ourselves that we will ever be." Isn't that a nice way to think of it? Because here we are in a state of ever-expanding consciousness, and even though we think of this little life as being so important and so much, in fact, it's just a little bubble on the great ocean of infinity. And more that bubble expands until it becomes the whole ocean, the more we see that this little tiny thing that we live, it's not that it's nothing, because we are indeed, even as we stand here, the full expression of divinity. All that we lack is the realization of it. And so in this beautiful story of the life of Christ, they wanted us, the great masters, they wanted us to understand who this little child is, even from birth. They wanted us to understand that this was an avatar. This is one who came fully realized. This is one whose power is limitless to bring others to God. This is how Swamiji explains it. This is the power of an avatar. Even a Jivanmukta, even those who are realized in this lifetime, have the same state of consciousness, Swamiji explained. But the avatar has infinite power to bring others to that consciousness. So even now, all these centuries later, the power of Christ is undiminished. The way Master put it so beautifully, he said, the power of a Christ never diminishes. It's an infinite power. It never diminishes. Even now, the same force that caused those disciples to drop everything to follow Christ. It's right there for us, for that we have ears to hear and eyes to see and hearts to receive. And so the wise men of India, the wise men of the East, saw this star and they followed this star. And the star that they were following was the star of their own intuition, their own inner realization that God was fully manifested in this world, and they wanted to go and bow at his feet. Now, they act, the masters act in this world, not for their own behalf. Yogananda, yesterday, and when we were listening to his voice, he said, I did not come for any reason of my own. I had no reason to come. There was nothing of Yogananda to bring me here. I came only to serve God, to serve the masters. So those holy men of the East followed the inner star of intuition until it brought them into the presence of the Christ, manifested in the form of baby Jesus. And there, what did they do? They offered gifts and they knelt down and worshiped. And why did they do that? So that we, very simply, they're acting out for us, that we should go to the East, which is into the point at the word in Hebrew is kedem, which is the point that goes before, and it actually literally means the forehead. That we look into this tremendous light of the Spirit. We seek within ourselves until we see his star, which is also our star. And then it goes before us, and we follow it. This is what Jesus meant, follow, follow me. But Jesus isn't walking on the earth right now. Those fishermen could drop their nets and literally follow in his footsteps. So now we have to follow that star inwardly. And we have to follow those teachings and those friends and mentors and spiritual guides who can show us how to walk in this way. And we follow that star just as the East. It goes before us and it leads the way and it brings us into the presence of the Christ. And then what do we do there? Do we stand proudly and hold ourselves as we are and sort of look, you know, analytically to see? You know, the masters don't have any time for such an attitude. When Master was alive, Yogananda was alive, he said, I came for the racehorses, not for the old nags. That's how he put it. I come for those who understand. I come for those who are ready. I come for those who have the courage of the climb. I come for those who have had enough experience of this world to be ready to put forth the effort to find something deeper and to find something more. And I come for those wise ones who bring their gifts. You know, what we can offer our material things, which believe me, we ought to do. But above all, what we offer is the gift of ourselves. But don't mistake, you can't just say that you're giving yourself and then have it no tangible form, no service, no generosity, no helpfulness to others. Last week we had the reading about Jesus. You know, you visited me when I was sick. You helped me when I was imprisoned. You fed me when I was hungry. You clothed me when I was naked. All of these are very tangible ways in which we take that which we have and we identify with a greater reality. It's not just helping the weak. It's helping to bring this consciousness of divinity into the world. This is why really very fundamental to all spiritual teaching has always been the simple concept of tithing or giving or donating or pledging. You know, people say, well, spiritual works, you know, it shouldn't be about money. But why not? Because spiritual path is about self-offering. The spiritual path is about identifying with a reality greater than our little self. The spiritual path is about having faith and an understanding that our real security comes from God. And it's easy to give lip service to those things. And then we ask people to say, well, the Bible says give 10% of everything that is yours to a spiritual cause that inspires you. Give it to the path that you follow, give it to others that they may serve God with it. And we say, yeah, yeah, but. And then in our prayers we say, oh Lord, come to me, come to me. I'll give you anything except something. You know? That's why the wise men gave gifts. They gave costly gifts, frankincense, myrrh, gold. They traveled a long distance and then they prostrated themselves at the feet of the child. You know, they stretched out full length, prostrating themselves in front of the image. In India, it's so commonly done to kneel down on your hands and knees and put your head all the way to the floor. In this country, we don't live on the floor as much as we do in India. But often, there's no other way to express yourself. When they brought these statues of at Ananda Village recently, we had carved some beautiful marble statues, almost full-size, life-size statues of the masters, and they dedicated the statues at Ananda Village in Hansa Temple. And Swami Kriyananda was there, and he only stayed a short time. This was last summer. But he just walked up to the statue of Master and he just laid himself completely out on the ground, prostrating like this in front of it. You can think about that. Oh, what a dramatic gesture. But you know, we have to get our own attention. It's not that God needs to see us lying on the floor. It's that we have to feel inwardly moved to such an extent that nothing less than that will express it. You see? It can't be for show. It can't be for impressing others. But it has to be the genuine and true attitude of our own hearts. This is what happens when you follow the star. This is what happens when we turn our two eyes into the single eye of spirit, which is how Jesus puts it elsewhere in the Bible. If thine eye be single, thy whole body will be full of light. If with the double eyes, we see this world. Dull by comparison, bright and beautiful and joyful as it may seem, it's just the last and most compressed expression of that true light. If we follow that star, which is whatever happens in this world, we constantly inwardly refer it to that simple thought, follow me. You know, it's sort of a joke these days, what would Jesus do? But that's really such a wonderful thought. It's one of the most beautiful thoughts that's ever come out. Not in a dogmatic sense and not in a unimaginative sense. You know that Jesus would always be rigidly demanding. But what would Jesus really do? I will draw a comparison between Swami Kriyananda and the life of Christ because he is, for so many of us, the living personification of the path of self-realization. I wrote the book, Swami Kriyananda as We Have Known Him, which I encourage all of you, if you haven't read it, to read it. I'm surprised how many of you haven't. But what I wrote in that book was very simple. I wrote over and over, story after story, what we would do, what a person does in the face of absolutely ordinary life situations when you're following that inner star. If self-realization is the goal, how do you live? How do you relate to your friends? How do you deal with adversity? What about lawsuits? What about personal weaknesses? What about betrayal? What about slander? What about great compliments and praise from everyone? What about huge success? How do you follow the star? And I over decades, I witnessed, have witnessed Swami Kriyananda's behavior, most notably, not because it's magnificent and different, but because it's so much like the life we live, only it's following the star. That's what Jesus came to show us, starting with his birth, starting with the wise men. Inwardly, be still, see that divine light, and walk where it leads.